Vayar Balak ben Sipor Eish, Kol Asher Aso Yisrael, La Emori. Balak the son of Sipor saw all that Israel had done to the Amorite. Vayagar Moav Mipnei Ha'am Me'od Kiravu Vayakats Moav Mipnei B'nei Yisrael. Moab became very frightened of the people because it was numerous, and Moab was disgusted in the face of the children of Israel. Vayomer Moab El Ziknei Midyan Ata Yilachachu Hakohol Es Kol Seviv Oseinu Kilcho Chashor Eis Yerek Hasodeh Uvalak ben Sipor, Melech Moav, Melech Limoav ba'esahi. Now the congregation will lick up our entire surroundings as an ox licks up the greenery of the field. Balak, the son of Sipor, was king of Moav at that time.
OU Israel presents...
Come in. Welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for the Parsha which we read in Eretz Yisrael this Shabbat, Parshat Balak. For those who are listening from Chutz La'aretz, it'll give you a preview of your next week's Sedra, since you will be reading Chukat. And every so often I like to remind people, especially here, that it is not you who are lagging behind us, it is we who jumped one ahead. Now that practically means the same thing, but in the origin of the system, the development of the system of our yearly reading of the Torah, the system was developed in Chutz La'aretz, where they had 2 days Yom Tov, and we, who have 7 days of Pesach rather than eight, on years like this one, where the Seder was Friday night, or what Chutz La'aretz people would call the first Seder, was Friday night, it meant that the following Shabbat, for us, was after Pesach, and we continued with Parshat Shavua, jumping the gun, because in Chutz La'aretz, they were celebrating the eighth day of Pesach, and would not begin Parshat Shavua again, until the following week. So, according to the rules, we needed to split a sedra, a double sedra, and read it in separate weeks, so that we would slow down and come back into sync with the Chutz La'aretz reading. Of course, Israelis like to say, that in Chutz La'aretz they read the double sedra to catch up to us, which again, as I say, in essence is the same thing, but in reality it's not the same thing. In the origin it's not the same thing, because Matot Maseh was planned as a combined sedra, and we will be separating it. If you followed that, fine. If you didn't, please excuse my ranting and babbling. Recording and first broadcast. No, we say recording and first availability, since you could get it on the websites, is Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 8th day of Tammuz, 5779, corresponding this year to the 11th of July. And now we got that. Let me tell you that the opening music is one of my all-time favorite pieces of a song. The song, which you will hear in its entirety, is called Matovu. The words, the first pasuk of the song, there's more, comes from this week's Sedra of Balak. And it was said by Bilam in a grudging compliment to the people of Israel, forced to say it by God, because Bilam and Balak had other plans, which were thwarted, and we'll talk about that more. But the trumpet solo that you heard is like 18 seconds on one breath of a trumpet solo. If I remember correctly, Nagina Orchestra put out the album, which I have in cassette. That's how long ago it was. And it was Shelley Gordon who was the trumpeter who did that solo, which I've always liked. So, you heard that, and you will hear the whole song shortly, but first, Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hamalot, Mimamakim Kraticha Adonai. Excuse me. Adonai Shimavakoli Tehiena Aznecha Kashivot Lakol Tachanunai. Imavonot Tishmoria Adonai Mia Amod. Ki Imcha Hasalicha Lama Antivare. Kiviti Adonai Kivata Navshi Velidvaro Hochalti. Nafshi Ladonai Mi Shomerim Laboker Shomerim Laboker. Yachel Yisrael El Adonai Ki Imadonai Hachesed Vaharbe Imo Fidut. Vehu Yifde et Yisrael. Mikol avonotav. Achinu kol beit Yisrael, hanatunim batzara uvashivya, haomedim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, hamakom yirachem aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara l'yirvacha, umeafela l'ora umishibud l'geula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. Parshat Balak is, on the face of it, extremely simple to present. Obviously, there are nuances in the psukim and the words, and you could spend a lot of time, as the commentaries do, with various things that are said. But if you look at it from a step or two back, you see a startlingly simple presentation. In addition, it's also unique, and I'll tell you why in a moment. The Sedra is 104 psukim long, making it around the average length of a Sedra in the Torah. It is subdivided into two parshiot. The parsha, in one definition of the word, runs from blank space to blank space in a Torah scroll. In a Torah scroll, there is no punctuation, there is no vowels, doesn't indicate the end of chapters or the end of verses. The only thing that you can see in a Torah scroll is what's known as a parsha, which can run anywhere from a verse, or even less, to 100-plus verses. There are two sedras that are entirely one single parsha, and there are other sedras that have 20, 30 parshiot, much smaller ones. Balak is made up of a 95-pasuk parsha, followed by a 9-pasuk parsha. There's where you get your total 104, or 104, pesukim. And let's talk about each part for the moment separately. The 95 verse, which is very large, my guess is it's the third largest parsha in the Torah. Not talking about the Sedra of the week or Parsha LaShavua. It's a different definition of the word Parsha. The Parsha of 95 Psukim contains the entire story of Balak, king of Moab, who hires or attempts to hire Bilam, the world-renowned prophet and soothsayer of the non-Jewish world, some say rivaling Moshe Rabbeinu in certain aspects of his prophetic powers. Balak attempts to hire him to curse the Jewish people because he is aware of the fact that the Jews, the Israelites, have already defeated bigger and better armies than Balak has at his disposal, and he was scared. And the people were a large people. I don't know how many people there were in Moab at the time or in Midian, but the Jewish people numbered 2 to 3 million who were camped in the wilderness, who had already avoided confrontation with two city-states and defeated two others, and Balak was scared. And he did research, probably, and he found that the power of a prophet might be the only way to achieve what he wanted to do to the Israelites. There is a discussion between God and Bilam about not going because the people are blessed and he has no permission to curse them, of yes, going, but be careful to do only what God says, of not going, refusing, then accepting, then being told he shouldn't have accepted, then he was told, you're here already, continue. And the famous part of the donkey that he's riding on, Bilam is riding on, having the power of speech and having a conversation with Bilam, which we'll get to in a little bit more detail. The rest of the 95 Psukim discuss the failed attempts to curse the Jewish people. Balak is offering tremendous amount of wealth to Bilam if he would simply curse the people. Bilam had a reputation of being able to invoke curses on people and was very powerful in that realm. And Balak wanted him to do that to the Israelites. God had other plans. And every time Bilam opened his mouth, God put into his mouth what to say, and he came out with some of the most beautiful descriptions of the people of Israel, including the Matovu Halecha Yaakov, how goodly are your tents, O Yaakov, and your dwelling places, Israel, but other beautiful psukim as well. And Balak is so fed up with him that he sends him back to his Midian without any money, and he's had enough. The Sedra ends with those 9 psukim, which I'll get to later. Not a good ending. But for the 95 psukim, we have a very unique situation. Everything that happened to the people of Israel from Parshat Shemot, when they were enslaved by Egypt, and the birth of Moshe, and the subsequent plagues on Egypt, and the crossing of the sea, the Exodus and the crossing of the sea, and the things that happened till we got to Sinai, and the Sinai experience, and Revelation, and the giving of the Torah, and on and on and on through the entire Torah, from Shemot, Vayikra, Bamidbar, Devarim, we, the Jewish people, were witnesses to everything that happened to us. And therefore, the Torah has that power, that strength of being not a secret document that was discovered by one individual and you had to believe him, but it was shared by a multitude of people, all of whom passed down the traditions from generation to generation to generation, until we've got it and are passing it over to the next generation and the one after that and the one after that forever. Except for this 95 Pasuk Parsha, which happened on a hilltop overlooking the encampment of the people of Israel, without our being aware that there was a very serious drama building up on those hilltops. Nobody knew about it. We went about our daily routines, whatever that was. I don't think Moshe Rabbeinu or Aharon HaKohen, actually Aharon is out of the picture already, but I don't think Moshe Rabbeinu knew what was going on either. And the only way he knew and we knew and know is that God chose to put it in the Torah, which he dictated to Moshe to give to us. And that makes it unique because here was a threat to the Jewish people and a powerful threat. And God, in essence, said, I'll handle this one for you. You won't even know about it until you read it in the Chumash and in the Torah. And Kachaya. Now, if you go back a little bit to when we came out of Egypt, the multitude of people witnessed God's destruction of the Egyptian army. Even though we didn't participate, we saw it. And subsequent battles, like Amalek, for example, was a partnership between God and Moshe and Aharon and Hur and Yehoshua and the army. And all the battles throughout Tanakh and ever since, including the ones in our own time, have been fought by a partnership of God and the people of Israel. Whenever God was not a participant, a partner, an active partner, we failed. Whenever he was an active partner, we could only succeed. So this time, and only this time, although we don't know about others, could be, God, in essence, said, I'll take care of them and I'll let you know about it later. And when we read these 95 verses, they strike us almost as a comic farce. Because Bilaam passionately wanted to destroy or curse the Jewish people. So did Balak. Balak was willing to finance in big terms. They built altars and they offered sacrifices repeatedly, seven bulls, seven rams, and again and again, 21 of each animals, and there was significance in the numbers, all to no avail because we were protected by God. And whatever happened there, we know only because the Torah tells us. Anything else in the Torah, we know because we saw it. We witnessed it. And if we didn't, then our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents and all the way back did. This is different. What's sad is that at the end of the farce, when Balak has had enough and he sends Bilaam on his way, Bilaam's parting shot is to suggest to Balak or Balak to suggest to Bilam. And this was an alliance between Moab and Midian, which was very surprising since they were enemies of each other. But unfortunately, when the Jewish people are the common enemy, then non-Jewish enemies will throw aside their differences and join forces. And this needed both the Moab and the Midian contingents to pull it off. And basically it was like this. If you can't beat the Israelites by war, then let them do something, and you make sure that happens, that will get God angry at them, and you won't have to fight them. God will fight them. And so it was, Kachaya, where you had the plan was to seduce Jewish men by beautiful women to the orgiastic worship of an idol, a pagan idol called Baal Peor. And when the Israelites turned their back on God, that's when a plague broke out, and the death toll was 24,000 Jews until the Makefa, the plague, was stopped by the bold, zealous action of Pinchas, which is at the end of the Parsha and leads into next week for further details. But that's your breakdown. If you can't beat the Jews straight, get God angry enough at them, and they will be shooting themselves in their own foot. And so it happened. Off the record, I want to tell you what my original thought for the opening musical clip was going to be. In fact, I downloaded it and was ready to put it on, and I felt that it was would be perceived as a little irreverent. I wanted to have Mr. Ed speak, as he did at the beginning of every one of the shows. Hello, my name is Mr. Ed, or I'm Mr. Ed, whatever. And then the music that follows, and the horses, of course, etc. And I was even going to make a comment that the horse and the speaking donkey, Lahavdil, in the Parsha, can mate and produce Francis the talking mule. But I rejected that. But at the same time that I rejected it, they said I was going to mention on the air that I was thinking about that. But it's important to know why I scotched the idea. And that is because the power of speech given to the donkey in Parshat Balak, we say in Pirkei Avot, we read, learn in Pirkei Avot that there were 10 special creations that God made in the last instant before the very first Shabbat. And one of them was Pi Ha'aton, the mouth of the donkey. However you want to relate to the experience that the Torah tells us about Bilam and the donkey, it's not to be taken lightly, because it carries the message to Bilam and to all of us. To Bilam, it was you value and cherish your power of speech. I will show you that a donkey, your donkey, can have the power of speech, however briefly, and is privy to certain things that you are not. Remember that the donkey saw an angel threatening on the pathway 3 times, and each time, one time he deviated and was whipped by Bilam, another time he tried to go past and got Bilam's leg scraped, and he was beaten, and then he just plopped down on the ground because there was nowhere to turn, for which he was beaten a third time. And only later, the Torah tells us that Bilam finally saw the angel, and the message has to be clear to him. You saw the angel now. The donkey's been seeing it all day long. You talk big. Here's a donkey who's talking intelligently. That's where the power of speech comes from. In fact, I will try to play, maybe at the end of the show, Ochila Lakeo, a beautiful prayer which the Chazan recites and which has beautiful haunting melody attached to it now, recently, on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, about the fact that a person can think whatever he wants in his heart, but the ability to formulate it and to have it come out of his mouth is a gift from God. Which is why we say, Hashem, Sifatai Tiftach Ufi Agid Tehilatecha. I have these feelings in my heart, but you have to help me open my mouth and say them. And then when we finish the davening, the Amidah, we say, Yihyu L'Ratzon Imrei Fi, may it be desirable to you the words from my mouth, V'Hegyon Libi L'Fonecha, and also the musings of my heart. Obviously, we recognize that prayer has to be sincere in the heart, but also has to be eloquently presented with the mouth. And the Chazan, on those occasions, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, asks, recognizes that La'adam Ma'arche Lev, the person himself has the feelings in his heart. Umei Hashem, Ma'ane Lashon. And what comes from his mouth comes from God, the ability. Anyway, I digress. So what happened here was Bilam, three different times, came out with very beautiful and eloquent compliments and praises of the Jewish people, and Balak was having none of it. And it was only their plan to have the Israelites seduced and get God angry at them that unfortunately was successful, to the tune of 24,000 fatalities, which was stopped only because of the bold action of Pinchas, which will carry us into next week's reading. So let's listen to the full Ma Tovu Olecha, and then we'll talk more.
Yaakov Mishkeno Secha Yisrael Ma Tovu Olecha Yaakov Mishkeno Secha Yisrael Va'ani Berav Chazdecha Ava Veisecha Eshtacha Ve'el Heichal Kachecha Ve'yirasecha.
on the point of compliments and good description of the Jewish people coming from a non-Jewish source, this seems to be a common thing, that sometimes it takes non-Jews to show us not to take things for granted and to appreciate who we are. Rabbi Sachs, in his column in Torah Tidbits, began with what he describes as an old and bitter joke. The year is 1933. Two Jews are sitting in a Viennese coffee house reading the news. One is reading the local Jewish paper, the other the notoriously anti-Semitic publication Der Stürmer. "How can you possibly read that revolting rubbish?" says the first. The second one smiles. "What does your paper say? Let me tell you. The Jews are assimilating, the Jews are arguing, the Jews are disappearing. Now let me tell you what my paper says. The Jews control the banks, the Jews control the media, the Jews control Austria, the Jews control the world. My friend, if you want good news about the Jews, always read the anti-Semites." Sad, but occasionally true. On that note of non-Jews saying nice things about the Jewish people, you have the famous piece from Mark Twain, part of Concerning the Jews, Harper's Magazine, March 1898. "The Jew has made a marvelous fight in the world, in all the ages, and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, and the Persians rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality?" Now, I know some people, myself included, think that we're dealing with a grudging compliment rather than a free, smiley one, but certainly no less than Bilam, whose words were inserted into his mouth by God. This came from Mark Twain, and it's a very well-known and lovely piece. I like the following one also. This is by John Adams, the second president of the United States. "I will insist the Hebrews have contributed more to civilized men than any other nation. If I was an atheist and believed in blind eternal fate, I should still believe that fate has ordained the Jews to be the most essential instrument for civilizing the nations. They are the most glorious nation that ever inhabited this earth." I'll read that again. "They are the most glorious nation that ever inhabited this earth. The Romans and their empire were but a bubble in comparison to the Jews. They have given religion to three-quarters of the globe and have influenced the affairs of mankind more and more happily than any other nation, ancient or modern." John Adams. Okay, let's switch gears completely. I don't know if I'm going to be able to say this in a way that people will follow, but I'm going to try. There is an interesting situation coming up next Tuesday night. Tuesday night, July 16th, moving into Wednesday morning, July 17th, is the last opportunity to say Kiddush Levana in Israel. That time has to be adjusted for other places in the world, but let's look at it from the Israel perspective here. All night, according to our calculation and the halachic guidelines for when we can say Kiddush Levana, is that Tuesday night, all night into Wednesday morning, is the last opportunity. Middle of the night, there will be a partial lunar eclipse, which means the moon will partially enter the shadow of the earth cast by the sun. The sun and the moon are on opposite sides from each other. That is called opposition. In Hebrew, nigud. Nun, yud, if you want, gimel, vav, dalet. Nigud. And our calculation, which is not the actual timing of the birth of the new moon, nor the opposition, allows us to say Kiddush Levana all night. But then, at, around 10:30, 11 o'clock, the moon will appear to be diminishing, even though it's almost on its way to be full. And it's until full moon that we can say Kiddush Levana, but when it starts to diminish during the eclipse, one should not say it. Let's skip that for the moment and go through the whole eclipse. Now it's after the eclipse. You look up in the sky and you will see what looks like a full moon. A full moon is the timing of the end of the allowable range of days for Kiddush Levana. However, those who know the astronomy involved know that the the middle of the eclipse is approximately when the moon is full, even though we can't see it as full then. And after that, it starts to diminish. Now, on a usual month where we can look up on the internet the accurate timing of the actual full moon, that becomes irrelevant to our saying of Kiddush Levana if our calculation of the average Emtsa'i, it's called, Kiddush Levana, is before the real full moon. That's our deadline, and we can't say it afterwards. If our calculation of full moon comes out after actual full moon, we still have that extra time to be able to say Kiddush Levana. According to some opinions, this is the rule all the time. We ignore the actual, and we use only the calculation, which is based on the average time that the moon goes through its phases. There is an opinion, which got me very excited when I saw it. Not that it has very practical relevance, because, especially during the summertime, we have ample opportunity from the earliest time of Kiddush Levana until the deadline to have said it. And I would imagine that any Jew interested in saying Kiddush Levana already has. But let's say there's a situation where it will bring you to next Tuesday night and you still haven't said Kiddush Levana. So, depends. Until the full moon begins, until the eclipse of the moon begins, on Tuesday night in Israel, a bit after 11 p.m., the partial lunar eclipse begins. Until 11, the moon is increasing, even if we can't see it with our eye, towards full moon, and Kiddush Levana is still appropriate. Then comes the eclipse itself, as I already mentioned, where you shouldn't say Kiddush Levana because the moon appears to be diminishing. After the eclipse is over, which is around 2 o'clock in the morning, until about 4 o'clock when the moon sets, are 2 hours that are after the eclipse, but before the deadline for saying Kiddush Levana. So under normal circumstances, as I mentioned, you could still say Kiddush Levana between 2 a.m. and 4. There is an opinion that says if a person has witnessed the eclipse and understands what's happening astronomically, then he cannot say Kiddush Levana anymore after 2 o'clock or after 11. If a person knows this is going to be, but didn't see the eclipse, he still has till Sof Zman Kiddush Levana to recite it. If he saw the eclipse, but really is oblivious to the fact that it happens only at full moon time, then he still can say Kiddush Levana because his calendar said you can say it all night. Only a person who knows that full moon is passing and witnessed it. Seeing is not enough. Knowledge is not enough. The combination of seeing and knowledge is so powerful that it prevents us from saying the bracha after the eclipse is over, even though the official deadline time has not arrived. And on that note, I will wish you a Chodesh Tov, a Shabbat Shalom. I'm putting on now Ochilo Lokel, and my parting word, which I really don't know if it's a legitimate word, but I took it from Lehitraot, to be seen again, Lehishtamea, to be heard again. So again, Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtamea.
Oy khilo loke akhalefono ayayayay esh alo mimenu ma anelosho oy Yagin, the healer said.